Thank you. Good afternoon. So I thought we would just discuss about Miles Stroh. I've put you a little bit, some references that I think are relevant for this clientele specifically. As Nicole just told you, there are not a lot of stuff written on mild stroke specifically, but there, it's growing now. The body of evidence about mild stroke specifically is now growing. So you have a few references here. And I wanted this to be more of a discussion, so feel free to interact as much as you want. So we will first define what do we mean by mild stroke, and then discuss what is it that they get as a healthcare, what the best practices recommend specifically for this clientele, what are their typical impairments that in this clientele, are there any consequences on participation, on daily life, and is there any consequences or impact or influence from the environment, more specifically the social environment? And we'll finish with talking a little bit about coping with about mild stroke, because coping is a topic that is of great interest to me. So that's why I put it here. It's not necessary, but it's interesting, my point of view. And we'll finish by, I want to hear you about what you can retain from this hour about what are their needs. Are there any gaps that you perceive? Do you find any solutions right now about what you will be doing in a clinical setting for this particular clientele? So when we talk, when we think about mild stroke, what do we mean by mild? There are many definitions, but they all come to this one, where it's a total absence or presence of only slight motor impairments resulting in a high level of independence in basic activities of daily living. And I guess you all know that basic activities of daily living are eating, getting dressed, moving around, using the bathroom, the basic stuff. So I'd like to know first, what do you think of this definition? Do you think it's fair, complete? Do you think it's missing anything? Yeah. Uh-huh. There is no mention of cognition? Yeah. Yeah. There is no mention of sensory aspect as well. Pardon me? Social. So it only focuses on motor impairments and on consequences on, there's no mention of social, we can say of social environment or social roles, but it's only on basic activities of daily living. So many people can fit in this definition and still have some kind of impairments, especially following a stroke, right? I'm going to try and give you a picture so you have a picture, that's the word, of what is a typical patient with a mild stroke. And to do that, I will use mainly results from a clinical trial that we just ended, which is the You Call, We Call trial. So just only that you know a little bit about the method and what the objective of this trial was. It was a trial specifically for individuals who've had a mild stroke, and we did use the definition we just spoke about to define what is a mild stroke, because that's how we perceive them right now. So anyone who've had a stroke with a Canadian neurological scale greater than 8.5, which means they might have only slight motor impairments, or if they had a modified Rankine scale between 0 and 2, or if they were discharged home within 21 days, they could be considered in our trial as having a mild stroke. So we enrolled these patients, and we offered them two interventions over a six-month period. The U-Call, which is the typical thing that these patients may have is we give them a phone number with the name of a healthcare professional who they could contact if they feel the need to. Or they were randomized into the WeCall, where we would call them weekly for the first 2 months and then biweekly for the third month and monthly for the month 3, 4, and 6. And we would discuss 6 topics systematically at each call and offer support and provide information through Stroke Engine. So we did gather a lot of data on this clientele through this trial, and we do have sociodemographic data, age, gender, and stuff like that. And we did measure their quality of life, their use of the healthcare, what health services they would use. And we did measure as well their participation level with the life age, their mood with the Beck Depression Inventory, and that's about it. Okay, so I will use a lot of these data just to provide you with a picture of what a mild stroke is. Okay? If you have any questions, you just... okay? Wave. So when we think about an individual who's had a mild stroke, we can say, based on these results of this trial, that they are relatively young. The sample mean age from the WeCall was 62 years old, and they range between 31 and 92. And more than half of these individuals were 65 years or younger. Okay, so have any of you been in a rehab as a clinical setting with stroke? You did? I guess were your clients mainly adults or mainly what we could call elderly? Half and half? Okay, it depends where you were. But typically, individuals, as you get older, you have increased risk of having a stroke. But mild ones are typically a little bit younger than what we may be used to see in rehab. What this tells me is that many of them are still working when they get their stroke. And if they are working, they probably also have a house or they have household responsibilities. Some of them may also have children that they take care of. Okay? And in the WeCall sample, you had 42% that were still working at the time of the stroke. And we had 64% of them that were owner of their house. So it comes with the responsibilities of taking care of the exterior as well as the interior of the house. And what is in red is that they are the greatest proportion of all strokes. They represent 2/3 of all strokes. And this proportion is expected to increase because of we're better at treating stroke in acute care. So if people react more fast, they get to the hospital faster, they can get thrombolysis therapy if it applies, and their stroke are milder, so we have a greater proportion, and also with the aging of the population, this proportion is expected to rise. Has any of you seen any mild stroke? If you've been in rehab or in acute care in your clinical settings, has any of you, based on the definition we've given, do you think any of you have had a patient that could fit into this definition? No? They're 2/3 of the stroke population, right? Isn't that interesting? No? We'll see. Okay. I guess why you did not see them is because they don't stay long in the hospital, right? So we want a length of stay, of hospital stay, to be reduced as much as possible. And I guess we're getting good at it because individuals who've had a stroke, they stay in average 5 days in acute care. And this is the length of stay for individuals in the you call, we call. And we have, this is the, frequency? We had a good proportion who stayed 0 days. That means we could recruit them from the emergency room. But I should tell you that we had a very tough time to get into the emergency room to recruit individuals. So that means that those with mild strokes who only get to the emergency, the proportion is much more higher than the one that you have here. So they stay a short stay in the hospital. Oh, I have the numbers here. Nearly 15% who were not hospitalized. They only went to the emergency. They had a stroke diagnosis, cyst, and then they were discharged home, maybe with hopefully with a medical follow-up. But they were not hospitalized. So it makes sense that as rehab professionals, we don't see them much. It's a good thing that they do have a medical follow-up. So in the first 6 months, nearly all of them did see their doctors, or they saw a specialist in the first 6 months. But when you look at this, only 17% saw an occupational therapist or a physiotherapist, and only 7% saw a speech-language pathologist in the first 6 months from this group of individuals. Then we can say, well, maybe it's okay if it's a mild stroke. They go back to work, and they go back and do their things. So that's the question. Do they go back and do? Is it mild with no consequences on daily life? It may be mild as a medical follow-up is quite easy. They get stable medically, but is it mild so that they don't need rehab? That's the question. When we look at best practices, I guess you've had a quick look at it already, or you're starting to have a look into these. The best practices are not organized as to stroke severity per se. So you won't find any recommendations specifically for mild stroke. But when I've looked at these, I thought this one was interesting when they say that all patients with stroke should begin rehab within an active and complex stimulating environment as early as possible once medical stability is reached. So mild stroke, medical stability is reached quite fast, so fast that they get discharged within 5 days. But I'm not sure, from what you're telling me and from the data that we have, that they do begin rehab. And if we think that they only 17 of them saw an OT or a PT, and 7% a speech-language pathologist, which are the rehab discipline, we could say. There are other rehab disciplines, but these are the ones that you can say you're doing rehab if you see one of those disciplines. They have not been assessed for their needs, if they do need rehab or not. They have not been screened for any impairments or any problems or challenge in participation in their daily life. And then if we think of mild stroke, that they are discharged fast, that means they are back into the community very fast. There's a best practice that says that people with stroke living in the community should have regular and ongoing follow-up to assess recovery, prevent deterioration, maximal functional and psychosocial outcomes, and improve quality of life. Have any comments on this? No? Do mild strokes have impairments? The typical ones that have been documented in studies is stroke recurrence, I've put it there, but it's not an impairment, you agree with me. But it's a fact that they have had a stroke. It means that it's the greater risk for them to have another one. Okay? So stroke recurrence is an issue to my knowledge, a sufficient issue that they've been at least a little bit educated about the risk factors. Fatigue is a big issue that is well documented now in mild stroke and may go unnoticed in a 5 days hospital where it feels normal that after you've had a stroke, you feel fatigue. A mood is a big issue. Depression or anxiety and cognition that we spoke is missing in the definition of mild stroke, but which is a common impairment after a mild stroke, where you could have a decreased attention, concentration, or memory problems, can have perceptual deficit that go unnoticed in a 5 days hospital stay, and increased irritability has been some things also mentioned or documented. I guess it's a. Oh, yes, yes. The question is, and you correct me, is the cognitive problems like decreased attention, is it a side effect of a potential depression or irritability? Because these are common symptoms of depression, or is it a parallel, we might say? Direct symptoms of stroke. I think we don't know. It can be both, and it depends on the case. My point is not to tell you that all mild stroke have these impairments. It's mainly that these impairments are common in mild strokes, and they are invisible. That's the big thing. So they will go unnoticed in a 5 days hospital stay. So the person is going back home and may have these impairments that have been unnoticed, even by them, because they were in a structured environment, and all they had to do was their basic activities of daily living, which they can maybe do, even though they have these impairments. Yeah. Yeah, so knowing about these typical impairments will make you think of these when you see the patient. And if you screen one of these, then you will go further and assess. And then the interventions will vary depending on the result of your assessment, depending if you also find depression or not, or if there was a... Yes? Mm-hmm. The question is, do we see aphasia in mild stroke? And I would say, yes, you can see these are the impairments that may go unnoticed that I've put there. But because it's a stroke, you can have a mild stroke with one arm not moving at all. And you can have motor impairments and still call it a mild stroke. Because the definition is, it's not strict. And as I've told, there are many of these. But most argue that a stroke is considered mild if there are a little motor impairment and if one can do their basic ADLs. But you can have any types of impairments with a stroke, no matter what we say. We put a label on the stroke to say what the level of severity is. But it's not necessary to label a stroke as mild, moderate, or severe. It helps us to be faster in our mind. When we see a patient that looks okay, but he's had a stroke, then we say, oh, maybe it's mild. If it's mild, do I look at basic ADLs? Do I look at motor? Do I focus on motor strength if I see him moving around? Or do I think of potential invisible deficits? Because it goes fast, and you have to prioritize rapidly what you will choose to assess. Yes? I did? Oh, wonderful. So this is not the, you can have any types of impairments, okay? Those are the typical ones that may go unnoticed because they mostly are invisible, okay? Now, I've put a table. It's only about 35 individuals who did fit into the definition of mild stroke. But just to show you the impact on participation. So we've asked them a few days after their stroke, we've asked them how they were doing their daily activities and their social roles before the stroke. And we've measured them 6 months after the stroke to see if they resume most of their daily activities and social roles. Okay? So this is the life age, the assessments of life habits. Have you seen this measure before? A little bit. Most of you are familiar with it. Okay, it's a measure based on the disability creation process. So it has 12. Are you mostly OTs? PTs? Other? Is this mostly OTs and PTs? Yeah? Okay. So what you have here is the mean score. The score is out of 9. But what you can have a look at is the p-value here to see which categories there is still a significant difference between the pre-stroke level and 6 months later, according to the life age. So we see that nutrition is basically back to what it was before the stroke. But nutrition is a basic activity, although it does include preparing meals. We have the second category, which is the fitness category, which is lower than before. And in that one, we have sleep, which is often not as good as before the stroke. And so you can see that for most categories, they are not back to their level they were before. Even for categories that we would think there are no issue about relationships, right? Do we bother about relationships in rehab? Do we assess the quality of the relationships? Rarely, right? It's not our big priority. It's not a survival activity. It's something to get life fulfillment. It takes a lot of room, a lot of space in one's life. But I guess we assume that it's on everyone's shoulder to manage about it. But what we can see is that although the difference in scores is small, because there's not a lot of variability in the scores, even if the difference is small, it comes to be quite significant, a decrease in the relationships. And the greatest difference are in the employment and recreation, where there is a bigger drop. So this is a small sample. It was exploratory. Okay, so you can say it's interesting to see that there is an impact over time, but is it significant? Maybe. We have some other data also with the LifeAge, with the You Call, We Call trial. If we use the Okay. Yeah, I'm going to try and repeat the question. So this is my challenge to repeat your question. The question, from my understanding, is that these are interesting results. and we're wondering, is it a decrease in participation, meaning that they are able to do the activities, but maybe not enjoying it as much as before. Is that what that's what you're asking? You wanted to answer? Yeah, there is a satisfaction part to the LifeAge. It was not included in these results. This is only it's not about abilities, though, you're right. It's not about, yeah, it is about doing, but it's not about being able to do. It's about how do you typically do it. And the scale is, do you do it without difficulty or with difficulty? Do you do it without assistance, with human assistance, with an adaptation? You take longer to do it, or with a technical aid? That's how the score is calculated. And so what it means is that if they don't do it, they get a score of 0, so it will drop. So that's why in employment or recreation it did drop, because if you have employment 3.7, it means that a proportion of them did not go back to work. So they scored probably 0. It will decrease the mean. But it's not about enjoyment. It's not about satisfaction. I did not use I've used it before many times, the satisfaction scale of the LifeAge. And maybe because, I don't know if people were always satisfied. They were always satisfied. And even sometimes, at times, I was telling them, are you sure you told me this and that? And then, because otherwise, I don't know if it's social desirability or what is it with this scale, but they were always scoring satisfied, so I stopped using this scale. I didn't find it sensitive enough with this clientele. Maybe with mild stroke it would be. I didn't use it with mild stroke. I've used it with strokes who used to be maybe older, because I would recruit them in rehab and in a small town. So it's not about satisfaction. But I do have some qualitative data that informs us about what it means to them. So if same type of patterns, if we look at the You Call, We Call, again with the LifeAge, if we assume that normally mobility, including driving, moving around, is supposed to be done without difficulty and without assistance, if we assume that this is what is normal, then we would score 9 out of 9. So this is the proportion of people you have who scored lower than 9 out of 9. So it means that they had either difficulty with the activity, or they use more time, adaptation, technical aid, or human assistance. So you have 51% who did not score without assistance and without difficulty for mobility, 26% for relationship, 45% for working, and recreation, I've put it there, but maybe it's not normal to do it always without someone, because a lot of our leisure we do it with someone, but it means that maybe a good proportion doing it with difficulty as well. Wanted to react or no? Those are the individuals considered mild. Okay, at 6 months. So what they tell us, some of the things that when we let them talk about their daily lives, what they tell us is that there are consequences of a mild stroke on participation. Maybe not for everybody, but for a sufficient proportion of them to tell me that we should at least screen them or follow them a little bit to make sure that we pick the ones that may need rehab, although they may not all of them need rehab. I should tell you that we had quite a high rate of refusal into the UCall WeCall trial, and many of the ones who refused to participate, it was because they've had the stroke but didn't want to hear about it anymore. They just wanted to move over and get on with it, and they didn't want us to call them every week. You've had a stroke, remember? No. They just wanted to forget about it. So it maybe it worked for a few of them. It may have worked, and maybe not, because they're in the long run, what we see is that for many of them, it has some impact. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does act as a motivator for many of them, because when you see, because I've followed them a lot, most of them will at least try to stop smoking. But if you see them a little bit later on, it's like anyone, it's hard to stop smoking. They won't all have succeeded. So, if they don't even want to be part of the trial, if they don't want to hear about it, I guess they probably won't go, or maybe not do the behavior thing that they should be doing, or that we say they should be doing. So on participation, sleeping, we've talked about fatigue. Fatigue and sleep is not all interrelated, but a little bit, huh? So they change. Like I said, it's not about satisfaction, but it's about the way they used to do things. It has changed. So one person was telling us, every now and then I'll take a pill so I can sleep a bit. So they will use medication or just sleep with difficulty. Mobility, there is higher risk of falls. And driving, I like this one. It's a big issue, driving. It's a big, very huge issue, and I know you'll talk about it. Yeah, so it's a very meaningful activity for most individuals who do have a driver's license. There's only a few of them who will say, well, I just stopped driving and it's okay. My daughter brings me around, but most of them, it's a freedom thing. So it's a very big issue. And sometimes they assess themselves. And that worries me. Like this lady, I came home from hospital on Saturday. And on Monday, I got my car out of the garage and went for a drive just to say I could do it. As a society, as a member of the society, it's worrying. See, and if they stay very short at hospital. I don't think the data, you know more than me, Nicole, on this one, but it's not yet systematic as to the advice they get. Sometimes it's very vague in their head. Oh, I stop for a few weeks and then I can try again. Or it's not always, the assessment is not always very clean. The driver, yeah, the ambulance driver. They all do. So there are consequences on relationships, and I have some more examples a little bit coming up. And working, many of them will go back. A few of them will go back full-time. Most of them will go back gradually. Some of them will decide to decrease, so to modify. It's like an adaptation. They will do it part-time. And some of them will just will say, oh, I was supposed to retire, so I'll just retire right now. So they will precipitate retirement. So they don't all go back necessarily to work. And here we can link it to fatigue and decreased energy level, which is there. If they put all their energy into working, when they come back home, they get more irritable with the kids, they fight more, they don't want to do the other chores. So it's not, when we say, when you know, I thought it's interesting about the being able to do the activity is one thing, but if we assess one activity in a silo, they may be able to work. They may be able to do the laundry. They may be able to cook meal. They may be able to do everything when you assess one activity. But the challenge is to get back to the life that we, most of us, are having, which is a challenge even when we're healthy. So if you've had a stroke, then just try and go back to this life. They may have to make choices and set priorities. And then ODs can be helpful to help them do that, and PTs can be helpful also for the tolerance and energy level. And the question is about sleeping. What is it about? Is it the sleeping cycle? Or I don't know, and I don't think it has been studied. It's something that they tell us. That it can be linked to depression. I know there is a lot of anxiety for many people soon after they've had the stroke, and it may act as an incentive to do the behavior change we were talking about, but many of them will be anxious when they sleep. I don't know. These were consequences at 6 months, so for some of them it does. It stays difficult to sleep in the long term, but to have looked at coping. Many of them were, it's more qualitatively, they were telling us that in the early period, they had, and even the spouse, and I have some interesting quotes for the spouse. Many strokes doesn't always happen during, while they're moving, while they're doing an effort, while they're very stressed, although it's related to stress. Many of the strokes happen while they sleep. They wake up paralyzed. And when that happened, the spouse stopped sleeping and just look. is that my spouse okay? More early on, as it go, it the anxiety decreases. That's a good thing, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it may have been documented, but I'm not aware. You had a comment? What do you guys think about, yeah?
And why not?
I want to be wrong with, okay, let's go on. I'm going to have a critical path, okay? Because you had a lot of good thoughts there. I'll zoom in on one, because I'm just doing a project at the Jewish Ria, and that's the other two. What would happen if you tried to put a group together over at the VIDIC or at the MUHC, the MGA?
What would happen?
Yeah. Can you think of the logistics? You're a therapist, and you say to yourself, I don't like the way we treat you.
They didn't want to be reminded that they had a stroke and they just want to forget it. But some people might be proactive and, you know, they are feeling
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, and I'm just thinking about when we just, if we just hang a poster advertising that there might be groups like that, as you say, it's very hard to recruit. And one of the main results from the YouCall WeCall trial is that the YouCall group, the ones that we've given them a 1-888-800 number, you know, free of charge number, they could call to talk to a trained healthcare professional about, they didn't call. We had only six calls out of 94 people. So they don't call. And Sister Liaison nurses have told me the same. She says, I always give my number and I tell them, call me back, whatever, if something happens. And she said, no one ever calls me. Did they call you? And they just don't call. People don't call. Yeah. They could email, and one of them actually did leave a voice message, and he got the information through email, but we didn't have the chat. But I'm quite sure that we wouldn't have much more than what we did get. And even though they had some challenges, because what people that we would call told us, a few of them told us that they were glad that we were calling because they would have not have called, even though they had some issues that they were glad to discuss with someone not in their family or immediate surrounding. So people won't call you. If you tell them, call me if anything happens, they won't. You can do that. It works. You don't even have to plan time in your schedule for that. They won't call.
When I was doing my stage in acute care in this med, a lot of my patients, I did a lot of education in acute care, and the dissemination of information was during that short period, in less than 1 week. You know, these are the symptoms that you will,
okay,
in the future you will get or may get, so you have to be aware and do the problems. And, you know, we don't necessarily have the pamphlets, but I printed them out.
Did you see the mild stroke while you were in acute care? Because that's the big point. As Nicole told us, at Royal Vic, they get paged if there's a stroke for driving specifically, because driving is a big issue. But if you go at Hôpital Notre-Dame, the OTs over there, they don't see the mild strokes. They don't see them. They are not referred to rehab. Well, mild strokes, typically, they, to my knowledge, there is not the resources in our acute care hospital right now, so that it's not systematic from what I know, that all strokes get to see at least one of the rehab professionals. It's still a referral process that the neurologist will refer if he screened some rehab needs. But if it's considered mild with basic ADLs, it will discharge. And 5 days is the mean. So, and I told you it's an amplified mean of 5 days because we only had 15% in emergency room, but we could not recruit. We were not good at recruiting in emergency room because it was going too fast. Because of ethics, we had to have consent for them to provide us their contact information. So they had to be there at least long enough for a nurse to ask them, do you agree that we give your name to the research team? And that we were not good at recruiting an emergency room. So it means that there are a lot of strokes that only get to the emergency room and go out. I don't think that they see a rehab to provide them with education. If they get admitted. Okay. Okay. It's getting there. It's getting there. I think that's where we want to go. So hopefully we will get there, that there's no more need for referral, but right now it's not all over the place yet. So many of them just leave without the education. They have to find it on their own. And there's their leisure is decreased, and I've just put you this reference, which is not for me, but it is quite interesting because they focused on high leisure demand, high leisure activities, to moderate and high intensity, and they also observed an important decrease in these activities compared to before the stroke. So this is an interesting article as well. So there are consequences on participation. One of my interests also is to look at the social environment. Because we don't live in a silo, we all interact with others, and when we think of participation, there are many of the daily activities that we share with other people, and that's what gives us the opportunity to do as much as we do, because we don't do everything on our own. So, Myriam Tellier, who worked with me a little bit at her master's thesis, she interviewed spouses of individuals who've had a mild stroke, only 8 of them. But what came out is, I've just put you a few, there are more results than these, but I thought these were interesting when we were talking about impact on relationships. It gives a good example as how it impacts. So, the spouse was reporting that the individual with the stroke has no energy, everything is an effort for him, is more irritable because he realizes limitations. And they themselves, the spouse, now found that they had lack of time for their personal activities, and there are financial concerns as well. When you go to full-time working, to a part-time working, or even if you precipitate retirement, or if you take a leave of absence, if you don't have the insurance, there are many issues there are financial concerns. So the spouse was telling, I have a lot more things to do. In the end, I had to do everything. Or with the stroke, my wife is unemployed, which has really reduced our income. That is bound to cause concern, even anxiety. And when we think about the conjugal relationships, I wanted to point out that we are very negative today, right? I don't want you to get out of the room depressed because, oh, mild stroke, it's so terrible and we don't do that much. For some people, it's a good thing it happened. For some people, it makes them realize what is important to them in their life, and then they put priorities and they make choices and their life does get better. So it does happen sometimes for some people. And even for spouses, sometimes it's a positive experience. I feel a lot more useful than before. I feel he appreciates me more. Or sometimes it's harder. I try to talk, but it annoys him that I'm concerned about him. Or it is like he was my child. So it does have an impact. It can be positive. It can be a challenge. But it has an impact. I wanted to just, and you already talked a little bit about it, coping. When we had the discussion about education or doing group or where they could meet people who have lived a similar situation, what happens with coping is that coping starts with making sense of the situation by, we call it appraisal. How do we appraise the situation? Okay, I've had a stroke. What does it mean to me? For some people, it's a positive thing, like I've told you. For the people who feel it's a positive thing that they make new choices, usually they will have a better participation 6 months later, and they will be less depressed also. Okay, so for the positive people, the positive thinker, it's a good thing. But to make sense of the situation, it starts by comparison. So you compare with something. And what's the first thing when we want to compare? What's the first person we compare to when we want to compare? Ourselves. Okay? So that's the picture here. I liked it. So the first person you compare to when you want to make sense of a situation is yourself. And with a stroke, even if it's a mild one, you compare with the way you were before the event. So you have yourself before the stroke, and you have yourself after the stroke. And even if the stroke is mild, for many people, it's frustrating because they are not back to the way they were before. And because most of them are isolated from other people who've had a stroke because they stayed so short time and went back to their life, they are the only ones. And the question someone said, they asked me, is it normal that I feel that way? They will ask you if you see them because they don't know, because they didn't see other people with stroke. And a story is the lady I saw who had a very short length of stay. She's the one who got back the quote about her driving back the weekend. She only had a little bit of diminished sensitivity at the tip of her fingers, which she would break a glass once a week because she would drop it. And she would not enjoy as much the TV programs that she used to watch before. And she would read less at night because she was not concentrated as much as before. That's the only thing. So she was back to life. She was back to work full time. She was involved as volunteer. She was back driving because she assessed herself and she decided she was okay. And but she was so frustrated because of this thing. And she was comparing herself to before the stroke. And she was comparing herself to the progress she's made since she's had the stroke. And since she's had the stroke, it stayed the same. She did not improve. So she was very frustrated. The old man I saw in rehab with a severe stroke, was completely paralyzed, and then his thumb was moving. And he was so optimistic. You should have seen me the day I've had my stroke. I could not talk. I could not roll in my bed. I was dribbling. He has improved so much. Even though you looked at him, you would say, oh, my God. What will he do with that thumb moving? Okay. Thank God technology is now improving each day. But what do you want to do with this amplitude, you know? But he was coping really well because he would improve day after day. So that's what my reflection about coping and about we have to put ourselves into their minds. And it's to put things back in perspective, I think that what you've suggested, to bring them together, or to be able to meet other people who've had similar, or to make sense of the situation, to know that, yes, it's normal, you fatigue, you should be fatigued after you've had a stroke. It's the way we perceive this. So that's how we start to understand a little bit more coping. So, what do you recall from our today's talk? What is a mild stroke according to you? Now it's your turn. Because we have to identify the needs, the gaps, and we already find a couple solutions, but if you want to be realistic, what will you do tomorrow in your clinical setting? So what we think is if the stroke looks like a mild one, what it lights up in your head is, watch out, there may be some invisible stuff hiding out there that we should think of and maybe screen or assess. Why would you want to know about invisible impairments? So for some of them, the invisible impairments that we screen may be modifiable. So we think that they could tirer profit from rehab. I'm sorry. What is tirer? Benefit from rehab? Would you send them in typical rehab? Would you send them to a inpatient rehab? To stroke or to mild stroke, what do you mean? Okay. Based on the
diagnosis.
Okay. from my knowledge, sometimes it's based on diagnosis, but there's been a move going to, they call it program. Like there's the work program, the getting back to work program, or there's the parenthood program when you talk about outpatient stroke. But the way it's organized right now is that there is no direct link between the acute care and the outpatient. To access to outpatient, it's much more easier to get into inpatient. And we even have some tricky nurses who are referring patient into inpatient rehab only for a few days just to have make sure they have access to outpatient afterwards. So the system has to be, it's quite recent that we have the information about consequences for mild stroke. It has not been until very recently, we would all think that a mild stroke is without any, there are no sequels. They just go back to life. It's still quite recent that we've been studying this subgroup of strokes. So I guess you will have to make some policies changes to make sure that in some places it's already there, but that they have access to rehab, at least for screening if there are needs. And the few days after the stroke, you may not know what their needs will be. But you can anticipate about work, leisure, relationships, and education is a big issue. So, any comments? No? I only had two slides more to show you, and it was just to introduce to the challenge of acute care. And I think you will talk about this later on with Nicole and about assessments. It's OTs at the CHUM Notre-Dame. They were asking me how they could implement the best practice that states that they should assess all strokes within 24 or 48 hours. And they had a hard time to do that because if you've been to the CHUM Notre-Dame, it's quite big, and like many hospitals in Montreal, before they get the referral, there was a time and they had a waiting list, and then just to get there and make sure they had the trouble, and they wanted to know how to prioritize and what to assess. So there was one student who was at your level, at the master's level, who took that project on, and that's what she came out with. So I thought it was interesting. And what it highlights is it was just a guide to help clinicians to make sense of what to assess and what to prioritize when you're in face of a stroke in acute care. And we had two milieux, CHUM Notre-Dame and Maisonneuve-Rosemont, and the two groups of OTs there made different choices. And when we discussed it, it was quite interesting. One decided to go on with the full assessment, even though it would take maybe more than 48 hours. And the other one chose to go more with education template and make sure they would stabilize the risk complications or whatever, and then come back with a full assessment later on. But what it says is that in the gray boxes, those are the things that maybe we should highlight, should think of if we're facing a mild stroke. And these were more the complex activities. And that's what we have in our data. It's not, they can do their basic ADLs. But what we should be worrying is about outdoor mobility, driving, what we've been talking about, working, recreation, complex activities, fatigue, you know. So those are the things that should be prioritized with a mild stroke. That's it. Any comments, questions, thoughts? So from my understanding is that we're getting there. We now know that individual with mild stroke, it's not without having a stroke. There may be some impact sufficiently important that some of them may need rehab. So we will have to be better at screening the ones that may benefit from rehab and maybe think over another way to offer rehab specific to meet their needs, their specific needs, which are not the same as the moderate or severe strokes. Huh? Prevention is, in my idea, it's part of rehabilitation, hopefully. And I won't get into that, but I'm working right now on a very nice study on the triggers of stroke. And it will inform maybe how we will eventually improve the way we do prevention. Because there are some common themes coming out that for specific people, a stroke doesn't happen just like that. I mean, if it happens on a specific day, it happens for a reason. And it does happen a lot on birthdays. On birthdays. Yeah. Well, it can happen anytime. It does happen while people are asleep. But the day it happened is not banal. I don't know in English. But that's another topic, just to make you curious about it. But it's very interesting, and that's what I'm into right now. So, thank you. Thank you.
marks and stuff, and there's a structure to the course that says assignment. What I'd like to do, but again, I don't care, tell me if you don't. What I'd like to do is I've taken a fun look at all of what you sent me, the long pagers. So interesting. I had to go back and check who the patient was because I thought such very interesting. This patient is clearly acute. This patient is clearly subacute. It's like, okay, let's go back and read about this patient. So what I'd like to do is I'd like you to work in groups in something that's really interesting to you. So here, you know, balance, lower limb strengthening, or mobility and walking. So pick one of those three. You've already done it. And send me, but in groups, because that's where you really, that's normal. That's what we do in teams. We're going to brainstorm how we're going to treat this patient. A final, and that would be assignment one, would be how are we going to treat this patient? You've all done it already. But I thought today we could talk about it, and then you could go back and refine your assignments. Does that work? Is that okay for everybody?
Is it going to be the same requirements?
Yeah, the exact same requirements.
So it's the same amount, the same length, the same...
I don't think that in a hospital they give you 7 pages to write up. Oh, well, your PT's got paid. Yeah, try not to sit in front of anybody who can help it so that we have, because... So, what I thought would be fun to do is, does everybody have their one pagers up in front of them on screen? Or did I know? Okay. So, I should put the patient up. And this, for me, was a fascinating exercise. Like, I loved it. I loved reading them. I found it so interesting. So, I thought we could all start to share with each other.
Can you make it a little bigger?
Sure, I can maximize that. Oh, it's not letting me. I'll have to get out of...
You can just press a plus to the screen. There's
plus. Plus? Tell me where you want me to go.
Right at the corner.
Because I was going to just zoom in.
The bottom right hand.
That's okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a good idea. We could do it this way. Is everyone good? Can see? Okay, so 14 days. So what happens is this is what you typically get, right? You get this little story quickly and you grab the chart and you try to figure out, do I have time to see this person today? And oh my goodness, and would I want to go home and to the gym? And so this is real life. And then you start to quickly think, what could I do so at least I could sign off that I saw them within 24 to 48 hours or whatever, you know, so I look good. What in here then, so the 14 days is the first cue that the person's had a stroke 14 days ago. And so some of you told me this was acute and some was subacute. Sometimes it doesn't matter, but because I was telling you we're trying now to do acute, subacute, and chronic and doing treatment plans according to time post-stroke, maybe it does. So let's talk about that. There seems to be a little bit of family support, whatever. And then this is really the one, this paragraph here was really what I was more or less asking you to zoom in on. So if you all want to read it one more time so you're back in the zone of this patient, make sure everyone's heads up. And then we're just going to go round robin and hear from all of you. Like, the groups should have a representative. impressions she sees, or he seems so quiet and withdrawn. What's going on? Is it communication? Does he not understand what I'm saying to him? Is he just exhausted and fatigued because he just went through busy? You know, like, this is how your brain's going to start going through. Like, what concept should I measure? And I do have a, lecture for you today, but we might not get to it now. Okay? Then I want to say, okay, so I'm going to do those screening assessments. What interventions am I thinking of doing in terms of my discipline and, of course, in terms of the interdisciplinary team? So I better talk to so-and-so if I'm doing that, and he or she's doing that. We can figure out a plan. And then what referrals? So today we heard, like, should I be doing a driving functional assessment referral right away? Should I be doing a referral for psych because this person seems just so depressed? Should I be doing some type of geriatric assessment referral outside of the typical stroke because this looks to me like there was cognitive impairment from the wife is saying for the last year this person's been going downhill? So that's how your brain is formulating. So if you always think about those four things, you can't mess up too badly. Okay? Where we mess up is if we don't pick up on problems that are important because we're not picking up on cues. So that's why I always like to use real patient vignettes with people, because then you say, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that happened. And it helps you to start to train your brain. So we can do this two ways. We can either shoot out some thoughts about the one paragraph, about where your brain went. So maybe we'll start with that, and then we'll hear from people what they actually wrote. Should we do it that way? Okay. So when you read the paragraph, so the preamble is just to let you know times and stroke and the construct around the family and the environment. But now let's get down to the stroke itself. When you read that paragraph, what are you worried about? What's your brain starting to go, differential, I need to differential diagnosis, I need to figure out. You don't have to put your hands up. Let's just do what we would do at rounds. We'd all interrupt each other and yell out.
Okay, so we wonder if he has neglect because he bumped into stuff. Like,
so, neglect, there seems. What's your cue? What words are making
it's
you?
It's written he has a tendency to bump into obstacles on the left.
Okay, so we're going to have a whole lecture on neglect. I was just up in Thunder Bay giving 3 hours of neglect lectures. Thunder Bay. Hawaii, then Thunder Bay. but Thunder Bay was better. I told the clinicians there, Thunder Bay was better than Hawaii, because Hawaii was a huge conference, lots of people really didn't care about the OT stuff. Thunder Bay was people who were eating greedily and caring and sending me questions and hoping I asked the questions. So it was like a real value. So that was better. I tried to persuade myself it was better than Hawaii, but it wasn't. okay, so your brain now, and this is how your deductive reasoning comes. If you're going to be a good clinician, a great clinician, deductive reasoning. So your thought is, okay, I think I'm worried about neglect or something into that thought. Then you say, we haven't had a lecture yet, but for those of you who know, what kinds of neglect are there?
Facial and subconscious.
Okay. So there's different kinds and there's different names for it. So in English we would say representational, okay, of an environment. But we're not going to do all of that today because it's going to go too far away from our goal today. But the one cue you need to know is that this person is having trouble far away from them, right? Outside the world, USM. So that's called far extra personal space neglect. So you're starting to think, and when I do the lecture, remember what we just talked about now, I'm going to show you what clinicians in Canada typically do to measure neglect and how we need to do it better. Because this person will score wonderfully on the typical paper and pencil test. Why? Because too close. Okay. And these are the same kind that Annie was referring to who have mild stroke and they go home and drive and their only neglect is far extra personal space. And so no one picks it up when they're in the hospital because the brain goes to, yeah, I care about knowing that, because even though I came up today to plan a balance training with this patient, I know that if they have neglect, and you were saying, you were saying there's a type of USM that will influence even how our bodies are represented. So you will see someone with stroke, and they'll be like this, and they're like, you see that, right? You said, yeah, with confidence. And you say to yourself, oh, I bet you it's because their left side is weak. Doesn't that throw? Stroke is complicated, but it's so much fun to treat. Because once you finish this course, I hope that you'll feel more of a sense of knowledge. And then it's so much fun. Because someone else will be going, oh, look how Mr. So-and-so's hanging over, and he's got too weak a left side. And you'll straighten up and say, Mr. So-and-so, can you move your leg for me and touch my, you know, your foot to my hand? So you'll say, I don't think that explains all of it. I don't think motor is explaining all of it. This person's midline, there's a neglect over there. So everything now for me is this bit. So right here feels pretty good in terms of my middle. Now why are we talking about this? The neglect is not coming for three more lectures, I think. Well, it's our balance training today because that was one of our goals. Okay, so that's why it's important, and it was good that you picked up that was one of the cues in there to say something else is going on too that's going to impact on my balance or my gait. And if you stand this person up, gait's going to be like this, maybe, too, if you don't know yet. What else is in there that would make us concerned?
Risk of falls. Risk of falls, huge risk of falls.
And why do you think that is? What is the risk of fall going on there?
Well, first of all,
remember, only problems right now. So just, like, we're on that complaining thing, problems. Cues. So you think, what would that be related to? So the motor.
The motor.
So you're worried about the motor in this person. So stronger, weak, lower limb. Right? We've got probably muscles then. What else then do we start to think about? If the person has lower limb weakness, what other things could be playing usually comes with it that we don't need to know before we start gait, etc.? Spasticity. We might need to check out spasticity. Ah, the whole sensor. So we've got the person, you know, over here, and now we say, okay, come, stand up. They stand up. We have no idea what's doing sensory. We don't know if they don't know, okay? And as you say, they might have something called anosognosia because this person is bumping into things on the outside. This might also be someone, and again, we'll cover this, but it's fun to start now. We'll keep reinforcing it during the lecture. This person might not even know where their body is, not even recognize right now their body. So that's all going to be a concern when you start your balance and your gait and your training.
Incontinence.
I know. Did anybody in this room ever have to pee really badly?
Yes.
Has it ever happened to anybody and you're just in a weird place where it's not going to happen soon? Okay. What happens when people start to talk to you and ask you all kinds of things and say, oh, do you remember what the assignment was last night? And what was she saying about, like, was it worth 30 marks or whatever? Yeah. So if every time this man gets up or this person gets up, they end up having the feeling of, oh, my God, oh, that would be so embarrassing in front of my young, lovely therapist. Here I am going to, you know, then the ability to concentrate, so everything is around that, okay? And then the other thing is stroke. What is the number one cause of falls in people with stroke when they're being treated in the hospital? Yeah, leading to, keep going, you're right. Incontinence, which leads to?
Fall.
Oh, the UTI is a good one, but why do I fall? Because it's the number one cause of falls.
Is it rushing? Getting up.
Rushing, not making it's an OT and PT issue. And if you look up Dumoulin, D-U-M-O-U-L-I-N, Chantal, she was a postdoc of mine at the same time that Andy Crochet was a postdoc of mine. And she's looked, she's one of the few people that's ever studied issues of OTPT and urinary incontinence and stroke. So all of these things make you an excellent clinician. That's going to be the difference between all of you and somebody who says, oh, I'm on the stroke unit. I don't know anything about stroke. Like, okay, because your brain is going to read this cue and say, okay, what do we have here? Do we have good communication? Are we worried? Do we need to spend a lot of time on the communications? You need scan data? Okay. Let's just stay. Okay. That's okay. Scan data. No worries. Okay, let's just stay here a little because there's one thing really important that no one's picked up yet. So I just wanted to stay in that paragraph before we. Yeah, no, if the person was originally disoriented and had somnolence, this was a pretty big stroke, right? So that's going to be our next cue. So yeah, good. Now we go down. I just want to make sure we pick that one. So keep going. Someone keep talking. And I'll eat my carrot.
Is there such a thing as, you know, before we go into the physical aspects, is there such a thing as rehab gradients, gradients for rehab, looking at motivation, looking at ability to learn, depression, so that motivation before you actually go into, you know, this is what you need to do, because if there's no innate, intrinsic need to actually be better.
Okay, so what have you learned? There are a lot of OTs in the room. What have you learned that's a good thing to do early on? What measure?
The COPM. So you can look that up for those of you who don't know anything about it. So that would be maybe an issue to start saying, what are you motivated to do? Sorry? It depends on who you are. Some of the people in the group think it's an acute care patient. Some of the people in the group think it's a subacute. So we're going to talk about that.
But isn't this individual in a rehab setting?
But it's in terms of people.
It's a various stroke. Like, this gentleman seems like cognitively there, but depending on the severity of the stroke, to go over to the COPM. Like, he's in rehab now, but it's in the acute phase.
Okay. So I like one of the things you said. He seems cognitively okay now. Everybody on that zone? Anybody need any further? Let's scroll down some more if you don't mind. Where are we going? How do we feel that we know that cognitively?
Some were accurate, so not all of it was accurate. And there were a lot of issues that I was concerned about with his cognition, whether it is due to depression or the pain that he was having, and incontinence. So the focus was it really cognition, or there are other aspects.
So you're going to have a whole lecture. So again, today we won't spend time because today we're doing balance and weight and whatever. But you will spend a whole lecture with Valérie Poulin, who will talk to you about executive function. And executive function, just quickly so we can keep having this conversation, includes things like, now you want to say any of the things that would be an executive function, higher level planning, perfect, problem solving, spatial reasoning, sequencing. Sorry, someone said something here.
Initiation,
terrific.
Judgment,
wow. I think we said most of them, right?
Insight?
Yes, absolutely. Judgment and insight are hard to measure separately. People sometimes, and they are important and separate, but they're tricky. We don't have good tools. Okay. Again, are you going to do all of that before you get this person to do some balance training? Or no? But it's all the things that you, as a high-level stroke-specialized clinician, start to think. Okay, you're thinking through, what have I got here? What am I working with? Do I have a good problem solver? Do I have someone I can use? You know, good mental thinking over and over. Will that person sit in the room and go, okay, my therapist, he told me to do this every time I need to get ready to stand up.
is that the type of patient, or is it the type that, you know, tries to get up from the wheelchair, and we've all seen that wheelchair is breathing, and the foot is still up on the footrest, right? So that's why your brain starts to go to, okay, what am I dealing with in terms of cognition, simple conversation, we're doing well here, just in the hi, I'm your therapist, I'll see you, you know, 3 times this week, whatever. And then your brain is saying, okay, if I want to start this, like, this is a heavy patient, so I've got to have someone who's joining me in this journey, because if I'm thinking they're going to get up and come with me, but their sequencing is out of whack, if they do have a whole body image, because what's our clue in the next one? Where's our left arm? Right. So we've got this happening, you know, you're trying to bring it up out of the wheelchair, so, right? We've all seen patients. So your brain is saying, okay, what's going on here? And then, yeah.
I just have a question about the arm, like, you know, like, being
bothering you.
Yeah, it's bothering, but he was always, like, you know, saying that he has pain in the shoulder. So we were kind of like, is it something about, you know, like neglect, or it could be like shoulder subluxation?
So excellent brain thinking, right? So this is how your brain's going now. Your brain's going, if the patient has spasticity, less chance, whatever. Now, 14 days out, my brain is going, 14 days out, always blame the acute care, that's where your brain goes. Some nurse's aide or orderly, never our participants, of course, has pulled that arm. Okay, that's where your brain goes. Not nice, and you're not supposed to go there. But that, you know, you start to wonder, right? And the fact that you came into a rehab room and this patient's arm is dangling, is that best practice? No. So on Stroke Engine, we have a whole module on positioning, because so few people are addressing positioning and the best practices or anywhere. And even where there's not gold standard of positioning, we gave the best evidence we knew, because there are so many sites. We used to use a roll. I graduated and we do this big fat roll under the arm like this, so that we wouldn't sublux the shoulder. Anybody using rolls anymore? You know what? Yeah. You know why you don't use the roll? Okay, so the humerus. Yeah, so the joint's really, so can everyone see? So you've got, you know, the glenohumeral joint, you've got the humerus coming in. It should sit with a little gap, obviously, when the patient hurts, it's because it's like this. And you can now, if you stick your finger where my fingernails are, as a therapist, when you palpate, you'll feel that. You'll feel the gap in it. Yeah, you'll feel it. You'll feel it right in here. You'll feel this, like, space. Okay? That's too late. That should never happen in our world anymore, ever. Because once you've done that, boy, this patient's going to have a long history of pain. Okay? So that is really horrible practice. That's not the best practice at all. So the other thing you're thinking, though, because remember, we're back to today, our goal is to focus on balance and gait and mobility and up. So what do you even do with that arm then?
Could the pain also be from the body and from the patient?
Multiple things. You could have broken a rib. Because often these patients are not that mobile. If you stay put, right, it could be many, many things. So those that are, that's where your brain is going. Your brain is going to say, can I accurately have a conversation? Do I get accurate information? I understand you had a fall. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened? What's that one question going to do in terms of executive function, in terms of all the things you told me? Recall, so memory. We're getting in there. We're getting sequencing, if it makes sense, the story. Or if it's like, oh, I was going to eat, whatever, and then you're thinking, no, I know he fell in the bathroom, and I don't know what this eat story is about. So sequencing, problem solving, you can ask, did something happen that you usually do differently? And he could have said, yes, I always make sure to, but this time, because I had to go so badly, I didn't put on my brakes properly, and I didn't walk with my quad cane in front, if that was the scenario, okay? So by
showing you're interested, you care, you're aware of the dossier, you start to go through executive function, little notes that come in your brain. Is this helpful? Or are we moving along on this? Read this, they decided to do. Because you're all different. I had so much fun every time I clicked open a line.
positioning. Because right now he's slouched, his arm is dangling. Mm-hmm. So in order to do the transfers safely, mm-hmm. Well, he has to be positioned with adequately before doing the transfer, which is, I guess, easily. Mm-hmm. So that's the assessment I started with.
We're not doing hands, we're doing yelling at each other.
Mm-hmm. So I agree with him. I was part of the sim, but prior to my sim and transfer patient, I would just do a quick functional screen just to see what is working. I was balanced in sitting position to next with my patient in there while I would transfer him. That's just a quick screen to see, okay, is this arm working? Is this arm working? Out of the trunk, out of the balance in sitting position before even starting the transfer. But then I would do the sim, I agree.
Did you think you should put a sling before you start the transfer?
No.
Just in case.
Yes.
Because arm's dangling everywhere, mm-hmm. you're going to come back.
Can hold the arm or be for sure the pin arm there?
Yeah, to support it.
Yeah.
To support the arm.
But I mean,
even when doing a transfer, right? It's, I don't know if I'm comfortable doing an assessment of a transfer with a patient without having an arm supported, because in my assessment, could have left the shoulder from making worse than what it was, so support it somehow.
I have a different take. Based on the case description, patient has no balance, not able to transfer, is not able to transfer on needs maximum assistance. So I think doing the thin for me personally would be pointless at this point in time because it can't do much. So I would do the pupil my assessment, it's stroke specific, and also the postural assessment skill for stroke. That's what I picked for balance and postural hygiene, because you know, he's able to sit, there's some sort of sitting endurance, but in terms of being able to transfer safely, based on the debate description and what we see, he's not able to do that. So doing the FIM at this point of time, for me, would be pointless, so I would do something that he's able. This is just my reasoning.
Have a ceiling effect, or
the
people my can have the literature that has a poor floor effect,
mm-hmm.
That close, and so we decided not to do people my, but we agreed with the pack because it's quick to do,
yeah.
So because the endurance is low, which
yeah.
we're thinking probably will be, that it would be too stressful for him to
right.
do the pack, and also we were looking at balance, so we'd be able to see balance in sitting and lying and standing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess with the same, even if he's not able to do it, it's something that's for baseline for us to use, and I think that we can use as we go along to chart out his goals and rehab.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the thin is quite important, even if it's a zero.
Yeah.
Something that we can use, because I know they use, when I did my discharge, I know the thin was key
mm-hmm.
in determining discharge or not, or whether they reach their goals or not.
It's a good outcome measure to
yeah.
use. It's not, it doesn't take very long, and it's just
but when
you
way
to sort of track the patient.
Wouldn't you just say, well, he's scoring zero, and then actually do an assessment that would, like,
but
keep
like, you wouldn't know that he would score a zero unless you look at it.
Yeah.
You can't just guess, well, this patient looks like he would be a zero.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I guess one of the reasons why I chose the FMA, it's lengthy, but one of the reasons is because it's just specific, and you're able to determine the severity, and you're able to plan and use that as and assess the treatment, so in terms of progress, you're able to see it. I think in terms of, I'm more comfortable because it's stroke specific, but it is very lengthy.
How long would it take?
Type it in stroke engine. We have the quick table.
So you can, if you're targeting specific, just lower extremity.
I'm not sure if I would use this assignment, but if you only do the lower extremity, it won't take too long. It's like 20 minutes.
That's 35 on the table. So I guess it's on that stroke engine table, so it's 30 to 35 minutes.
If it's, because it has two parts.
Okay.
Well, upper and lower. I don't know which part.
Her suggestion is maybe just do the lower
one. The lower one, yeah.
Yeah.
But
for the FMA as well.
Yeah.
And it's used for intervention and to see through the
line and standing and also during transition. she gets distracted easily. It's very short and it's simple to do. And it assesses level of independence. And so we were doing balance. So we thought that it was a functional way to measure balance without having to do the verb balance scale, which we thought wouldn't tell us much.
For the
room,
I think it has some self-report questions. Doesn't mean that it's true ever because I'm not sure if she can answer the questions correctly.
But if you can manage the stuff
out of the article.
Finish that thought. If you don't think that, sometimes we say things but they're not clear. I think I know what you mean. But finish that thought with what is your concern about this patient? Use a word that would be specific to an impairment that would make you concerned about using.
Because she has cognitive impairment. She can't answer some basic questions correctly.
So are you concerned about communication?
No, cognitive.
Cognitive or executive functions like awareness of deficit or an anosognosia from the hanging over that may be not aware of this?
I'm concerned about her ability to handle comments from comments and the questions that you answer.
Okay. So that's really interesting what you're saying. The reason I probe you further is that there are a series of scales now that are really nice, and I'm not saying you should all write this in your one pager now at all, so don't take that as a cue to do that. But it's a self-awareness of stroke. And what we're learning is that even asking a simple question about self-awareness of stroke is a real quick buy-in for us about how we find treatment. So I think that's what you're saying. And there, if you type in Google self-awareness of stroke, you'll see there's some standardized measures that if you felt the need to use a whole measure, you could. So if you were planning a very complex, so if you're thinking this person is 42, needs to go back to work, he had a high-level job, he's had a mild stroke, and I'm not getting a sense like that he's really capturing all of what's going on, then just take a quick look at that, because I think it would really be worthwhile for you. Now, as a clinician in the real world, busy on Monday with a bunch of patients, I would just say to them, because often if you say, Mr. So-and-so, you had a stroke, they go, no, I didn't, or no one told me that. So all you need to say is, tell me a little bit about what happened and what brought you here. And you've heard that often. And they say, my daughter brought me here. That's why you're laughing.
Yeah. They always say, like, why did everyone not know why I'm here? Like, why did they keep on asking this question?
Yeah, I've answered that question 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Didn't you read the chart?
Yeah.
So you get that. So you have to be careful. That's why I'm saying there are standardized questions. You don't want to use that one. Because patients get fed up. And then you know they're cognitive, at least like they have memory. So that tells you a lot, too.
Yeah.
And you say, are you having some post-stroke irritation? No, you don't do that ever. Okay, intervention. So I think that, did you see how interesting it was for me, though, to open all your files? Because I got totally different even evaluation scales. It was fun.
Excuse me, for the specific type of neglect you had, is there like specific assessment?
There sure is.
Or it's just like a screening? And
for that type of neglect, you have to use like the Catherine or Diego's scale. We'll be talking about that at length. So yeah, you need a specific tool for far extra personal space. So the NIH scale has one little piece, but we'll talk about this Catherine Bergego, BERGEGO scale. It starts like the word bird, like the bird scale, and then it adds it. So you definitely would want to know why they're doing circles. But you definitely would want to know. Now, certain brain lesions in animals, and I'm sure you've all sat through biology and physiology and animal, whatever, when you didn't want to be there. Certain lesions in animals will cause them to go with this. Right? Seen that? You've seen that in video? And so sometimes we need to check if the lesion is in a similar location that's causing our patient to try to do what the animal is doing, but really just wants to keep going in the circle. Okay, so that there's many different issues related to where the brain region is. And remember that the brain is so sensitive that if you go 7 neurons over, you're going to get a different representation. And that's why it's not a package deal. You know, it's not like every time they have this, 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 and this. There will be some big middle cerebral artery strokes, and they will have a very similar clinical picture, and you'll say, oh, this reminds me of so-and-so that we treated. But often, because, especially now with TPA, with our clot busting, we're seeing the type of combos that we never saw before as clinicians, because they're able to reverse some parts that we would have seen, for example, in a stroke that we expect all of it to come together. So that's a fun part, too, is that we're seeing a much more interesting combo for milder stroke that we can treat more effectively. Okay, intervention now. So you all get different things, which is fun. And you can continue to pick, you know, balance or whichever one of those three chunks.
Sorry, I just want to ask one question, like, just like a scan of the class. In terms of, like, OT versus PT, like, when you found on your placements, did it, was it more PT's numbers, like, assessing the system, or OT? Like, just, like, the breakdown, like, I don't know.
I would say OT, because you don't really get a lot of pain.
Oh, really? OT did function, right? The good old days. So ADL 100% was stroke, ADL was, so the FIM kind of looked like an ADL because it was coming from the Bartel, which you've all heard of the Bartel FIM. And so it was like, oh, well, the OT did Bartel, so I guess they'll just do that. And then it became, how are we supposed to do it quickly in 72 hours in rehab to do the FIM? That makes no sense. Are they crazy? We'll never get to treat anyone. And so then teams got together, and then we had stroke teams, and then it made sense that, like, why would I, as an OT, try to do scares and whatever, and so, and then the speech therapist was there anyway. Now, obviously, if there's no speech involved, because there's no perception that there's a need, you know, so people cover for other kind of disciplines. But most good units decide together who's going to do what, and it makes a whole. So you're right, both things happen. There's no doubt that interdisciplinary management is superior in stroke. There's no doubt. We save lives when we work together. And there's no doubt in my mind, having been everywhere in Canada and many places in the U.S., that McGill is superior to all others in terms of creating OTs and PTs to work together and create this togetherness of the patient count. Fighting you about some discipline issue. And we are superior. Like, people envy the model that's working. And they like our clinicians when we graduate better because of it. And I've heard that over and over again. So it's a model that works. Even though we kind of make jokes and we have our little digs at each other, it's a love joke. You know, like the family. So I think our family of OTPT is a set model that is better than all of the others that have schools that don't even touch each other.
say 30% of people will have something just by working well together. Why would you not? Running nuts. Western. Toronto. Toronto will be fine. Big time Toronto.
I've heard from
I was going to say something nice like not so bad.
Because I have friends in OT and PT, both Western and Toronto, and people in OT don't have any idea what the PTs are doing or what they do. And they actually have to collaborate with one of their master's projects. I have friends in Toronto, and they are completely on opposite ends of the spectrum. That's interesting. We will not do well by patients. Okay, enough of that. I'm a little tangent person, so just bring me back to how we do it. We're good. We're good. Okay, we're doing our interventions. Interventions are hard to pick. We got lots to choose from. Basically, nothing to choose from, so it's easy to pick.
Are we only staying on dots?
No, we're going anywhere. Yeah, we're going anywhere. We haven't talked really about what gait and mobility we wanted to assess. Anybody have any ideas for gait?
So we started off with specific training, static, standing, weight bearing, balance, just standing with approximation and facilitation. We've done the deadlift before we get going into actual gait. Before we actually go into gait, that was important between parallel bars and depending what sort of assistance they needed, so from moderate to maximum assistance. And that also incorporated a lot of strengthening and, you know, perception and communication. So more task-specific standing.
Yeah, never make a mistake, especially as you're just getting comfortable in stroke rehab. For those of you who've already done it, you know what I'm talking about. Never make the mistake of getting a patient up and they're really excited and they start walking forward and the wheelchair's not there. And now you realize that, okay, we got the first two steps in, don't know how the heck to get my wheelchair back, and this person's not steady, and now decides, I need to sit down. Has happened to you, buddy? Yeah. And once they do that, and you don't have a wheelchair in your body, you're in really bad trouble. Getting them backwards is really good. So don't go there. Because, you know, somebody who hasn't gotten up, and then has gotten up, and then is excited that they're up, and if they're impulsive or whatever, they're going forward. So we have some rules in clinic that, you know, if you're concerned that a person's heavy, if you're concerned about neglect, if you're concerned about a foot drop, that after the first step, the foot is now, you know, caught and under, right, which you never want to go to, you should never, as a clinician, end up there. Just make sure there's one other person. Now, sometimes that never happens. If it never happens, then you got to get this person up, and you've got to be able to handle it. And so you all know how to do that. You've all had practice in kind of handling somebody with a stroke in some of your classes. Yeah. These are not conventions. okay. You said yes. Yes?
Do you want me to show you?
Yeah. Take somebody. It's only hard because of this. Yeah. So come over here, and we're going to grab you. Is that okay? And just flip up your, and just make sure you don't bang yourself if she knocks you around a little bit because they stick out of it.
Like, am I pretending she's in a wheelchair, or?
She's in that chair, and you've done all the intro, the cues, like your brain has already gone through all the cues that we're cueing, and we're just going to do this quickly. That's not our name. But, yeah, we've got the, this is it, you're this patient.
Okay.
I think you're going that way. I think you're left.
Can I pretend you're right just because that's in the way?
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I'll just pretend that you're right. Okay, I wouldn't want to be on that side.
Okay, good. Stay where you were. No, stay where you were because that's a great comment, okay? If she's there, she's way too. Okay, so it's great you did that. Maybe you weren't comfortable there. You don't want to stay there.
I'd either go through the front and I'd want her to use her unaffected side.
So this is your first time meeting this patient, right? Mm-hmm. And we know the description. We've got it up here. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of like thinking, okay, let's see what we got. see a little movement, and you kind of felt through, is there really a shoulder subluxation? Because now I have to go pick up this arm and go on the spokes. So you've gotten a handle on the back. You thought about, do I sling or do I just support in well? I'm certainly going to hold this arm very well. So those are how your brain's picking through. And now you're going to see.
My thought right now is with the left shoulder. I always had somebody, my supervisor, doing the transfers with me. I had someone with left subluxation.
So this is what?
Yeah, sorry, but I was going to pretend with that. Okay. One of us would usually like support it and like picking it up. So I usually always had someone with me on my own. So I'm trying to figure that
we're
out.
Not
how to do it
here.
If anyone has ideas, please help me. But I'm looking to see, so I know her right side is not affected. So I'm going to make sure that her.
That's a good point, though. It's a good point. Have you had previous strokes or whatever? Are we dealing with that? We know that. What percentage of her right side is affected? Anybody know that? You should from basic learning. Is that statement accurate? The right side is not affected. We say that all the time. What percentage of the right side is affected? 10%. Yeah. Okay, so when you have a stroke, 10% of our fibers run the opposite way. So we're going to see a little something, a little slowing, a little muscle that's not really changed, but nothing to that.
So I just make sure the feeding position that she had maybe a little bit, a little bit of a wider stance, and I'd use her right arm to help support her on the right side. So I've actually got her. You're sitting on your wheelchair, so she's using your armrest. And then, so she's going to help with the push for herself.
So where do you want her to go? Well, I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want you to be uncomfortable.
No, it's fine. I'm trying to figure it out. But
yeah, exactly. Relax, and we'll just all figure it out together. Yeah. Somebody want to help? Someone want to take over? Yeah, go ahead. Go up and help
yeah,
over.
Yeah, I want to scoot to be there.
Because you know what? You know why I'm doing this? Like, this is not part of the course per se. The reason I'm doing this right now, we're going to go through, we have time, is because there's nothing worse than not feeling competent at this. Because this makes you feel like the family's waiting for you to get the patient up. Everyone hears, when the therapist comes, you're finally going to get up, Mr. So-and-so, right? And then you're thinking, crap, that's me. So let's spend a few minutes, because it'll... Go ahead. She's called in the recruits, which is smart. Never be a big shot and get yourself in a situation. Call in the recruits. It's fine. I know it's crappy, this chair. We really will bring in a normal chair for them. But this is normal. This is what happens in a busy hospital. You're tripping over the urinal and the commode chair.
Yeah, well, it depends on the left side. I would stay on the left side because if there's
okay.
Less of balance, so
all right. Attach. Anyone want her on the right side?
Okay.
No,
I would be on the front, yeah.
Okay, good. Why do you want to be in front? So three people are going front. Get in front, for God's sake.
Because
you
can, like, the
foot's dragging, so you can block that, but also be secure. So, like, if they're teetering on one side,
so this is making you nervous. This side thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So stay on the side. Get her up. And do me a favor. You start to with your foot all weak and whatever. Stay where you are. Get her up. Whichever which way. Just decide it's time to get her up.
I was thinking of going to the front.
Go ahead, do whatever. It doesn't matter. It's not like you're not being marked on this.
Well, okay, I'm going to get you to try and scoot forward a little bit first.
Okay, perfect.
Try
you really don't want
to
try to get up in the back.
A little bit forward to the edge of the chair.
Okay, that'll give you a good idea about balance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And now the reason you don't want to be there and why these three people are getting sweaty and nervous is because when my patient starts to fall all the way back here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible. And this looks bad. You're thinking, who the hell saw that? And you're right. What's good is you go out and have a scoot. And then, look what I'm going to do. I got you. Because this is the weak side. Okay? So you have to be loose on your feet. As a therapist, if you're sweaty and locked in, you're going with them. So you have to be wide enough face, but loose enough that you can move. So when they start to tip you, you can, no, you're going back in the chair. The other rule is you always throw them back in the chair, but you have to
older adaptation. So my idea is, okay, I'm going to lock you in, right? I'm going to lock you in this way. I thought you feel the pressure up here, and now we're slowly going to get, now you're going to try.
Wait, which side is the affected?
The left.
The affected shoulder.
We've got the left.
Is
the,
okay.
Yeah. And I've locked it in here, so, and watch what's going to happen. I'm going to do it wrong this time. Okay? And then we'll do it right. So don't memorize this one. Just let's do it. Okay, Mr. So-and-so, we're going to stand up now. You're ready. You're going to push off with your strong arm there. And, okay, up. Okay. Right? Bad. Okay. Or what we do, because we forget, because we're so sweaty and happy that we got them up, is, okay, sit down now. And then we sublux the shoulder one time. That one mistake, and we sublux, okay? So we don't do that either. So what we do is, again, don't come in too close, they'll knock you over. If I take a 240-pound man, I have no problem, but I need to be far enough away, and I need to be ready. Someone said it to make sure the shoulder, the knee is not going anywhere, okay? Because I can control your whole body on my, you know, as long as I've got your knee. But if you start shooting out, right, so if you kick straight out, and I'm trying to say, oh, then the two of us are going down this way together. We will land together. But the weight of the person coming over is going to take you down. Okay. So what we do is the same thing, the instruction. I'm not going to go through instructions right now, but you would say, push down on, and you're stronger, and you don't say on your weak, and you know that. The bad side is, you know, so on your stronger arm, and then you come forward with that. Yeah, and that would be it. And then that's what you would do for now, because you try to feel about how long, and then their leg will start getting a little shaky. And you go, great, now come on, let's go sit down again, push down on your stronger side, and we're in. And then you could start thinking, that felt good, look at how quickly you're doing it. And now we have a rhythm. So now we trust each other, right? Because the two of us have gone up and down, and that feels great, and great job, and you're exhausted. And that's it, okay? So that would be the only thing, because now the two of you are a team. By not going too far away from the chair, you've gotten a sense of the balance, the strength, whatever, and you're also a team. You can do a little bit of that rhythm, and it's like we're working together. You see, we can do this together, and believe it, and maybe not.
But give the patient to me more than what I was doing.
Yes.
How gonna, if you're holding my weak arm, mm-hmm. How are you gonna?
If I'm locking your knee,
yeah.
And you can't stand it off, you're probably, yeah, go ahead.
Isn't it better to hold her at the waist, mm-hmm. and then rock her up to come? Because the chance
there's
of something
lot,
happens.
There's a lot of different ways you can do it.
Okay.
So there, you can be right in front. And you can, depending on the arm, and you can do, this is just in terms of trying to get sit to stand.
Because I have the same concern as her, because she's worried about that shoulder and that arm.
Yeah, the shoulder and arm will not get hurt if you learn to lock it.
Yeah.
It can't go anywhere. You kind of created a splint. And so, in fact, the opposite is that you're coming with in a much more natural. But you're right, you can stand right in front and do it. I mean, it's not a one, and sometimes you'll have no choice. There'll be two stupid objects on both sides, and you're just stuck. But what's important is, yeah.
Or if you are doing in front, because I think a lot of people are comfortable with that, what do you do with the arm? You know, when
you
just
do the crossover.
Yeah,
you could do the crossover. But what I've always found is the most important, and I could transfer, I'll go, you know, and visit someone who, three family members after a stroke, it's evening and whatever. Once I get a sense of the patient, if they're willing and cognitively intact, it doesn't matter. They can be 240 pounds. It doesn't matter. Once you get your bearings and you make sure your legs are never close together and you know that you're somewhere in the zone to lock in the knee and you get the patient to use, they've got a really strong other side, unless you're dealing with a bilateral stroke and you've got like all kinds of other problems, they've got enough strength that they've got the proprioception and they know when they're stepping on to come with you. And if you create that rhythm, there's nothing better than a smile on a patient's face when you say, oh, the first one was hard, but we can do this again. Come with me. And a smile on their face when they've done it three times and that third one was almost like a seesaw swing.
just, if, but you, what happens is we don't get enough practice. And it's really hard to practice on a patient. So we really just need to practice on each other a lot. And then when you get to the patient, you kind of know where you proprioceptively need to be. And so that's why, yeah, people do all kinds of the front. But to me, I, for a very dense hemiplegia, I want to be on the side that's dense. Like, because if we're going, I'm not so big. So if I'm, I've got a 6'4" person, and I've often treated that, if they're going, I'm going with them. If I'm in the front, I'm going with, because they're taking me down to the leverage. So I would rather be where I'm totally in control, and I'm just getting out. But again, you're going to find your own way. The thing, the important thing was that I don't get so excited to get the person back in the chair that I forget to bring the shoulder back in. So any which way you do it, if you're doing it from the front, you've got to bring that shoulder in. They're not going to bring it. And that one mistake will sublux them through and result in, you know, the painful shoulder syndrome and everything else you want. Okay, let's get back because we have 15 minutes before we're ending today. If you ever wanted to do that type of thing, if that's important for confidence building on a stroke unit, just say so. It's not part of the course, but it's really part of knowing how to treat stroke. You can't feel good if you're not. So we could just, whatever you want, we'll do. So if you want to do it one day, just with all different scenarios. Now, the other thing you have to know is one of the scenarios, has anyone treated somebody with cerebellar or ataxia post-stroke? Yeah. What happens if I stand in front of them and try to do a transfer with cerebellar ataxia? They kick you in the shin. So that's not nice, okay? So if you're treating someone, you see cerebellar ataxia where, you know, often they kick out like this and you think to yourself, I was taught to stand in front and get them up. Yeah, I did it once in my career. And a woman gave me such a kick. I thought she was, it was like in a football field. I thought I was going to land like a huge moment. And she just like, shh. And I just, I'm going to go back down. And then stood there going, and all she kept saying is, sorry. You can't help it. You know, it's like it was my fault. I stood in front of her knowing that she had a taxi. It's stupid. Anyway, a mistake you don't make a second time. So I think, again, thinking of all the different things that happen with stroke and knowing what to do and when it's going to be. Interventions. Let's go around the room with all your interventions. 15 minutes. And don't worry about the assessment lecture. I'm going to squeeze it in somewhere. I have it. I posted it for you. And we'll be doing it all along anyway, so we're constantly talking about assessment. What do you do?
One of the ones that we looked at was cycling. Because it was effort to be effective in the determined that J was subacute. It was determined to be effective in subacute post-stroke population. And so we would have obviously a large group of time, but we decided to incorporate that starting at about 10 minutes or 5 days a week. And then as we progressed, we would move from 10 minutes all the way up to 30, but just seeing has the endurance improved.
What are you working on again?
Okay, thoughts. What's the evidence for cycling? What kind of cycle are you going to need? Is this person got a regular cycle?
Like there's a lot of electronically powered, like their room.
Normal seat?
Yeah.
Can this person sit on a normal seat and cycle?
They need positioning in the front or the front.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. What about lower limbs? That's the amateur. All right.
So I need to guide it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like teaching a child to dance as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I like it though. I like some. I think yours is the one where you had some real practical, functional fun. You made therapy fun. Like I was reading it, going, okay, I can do that. It's good.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to ask that could be to work on like sitting balance. What are you working on? Are you sitting balance?
Yeah, so you're working on seated balance and also helping for balance overall. Because we're thinking about in order to have balance, what we need to start with, we need to start with seated before you can have any balance standing.
So when you do your final paper, do things like contraindications, special So are you going to, like, you were saying, are you going to strap the foot pedal and the hand, because the hand to the bar here? Are you worried about subluxation? Where are you going to put this hand? Like, cycling is a two-foot, two-hand activity. Okay, so you have to think through. Something that says, no, I'm doing reclining, but you have to say, I have considered that, you know, forward flexion and standing and sit to stand is important, and what are we doing with the reclining bike? Okay, so you can pick it, but whatever you pick, make sure you talk through, like, I know, you know, I was aware of that when I planned this, okay, so that I see that you thought through the whole picture. Go ahead, you've been wanting to say what you were doing.
Okay.
get in the stroke engine under incontinence, and it'll show you the different types. And usually we're dealing with a mix by this time. If we have stroke, neurological bladder, and if we have functional issues, I'm older, I can only take so long to get to the bathroom. Now it's taking me 3 times as long to get there. And then I've got to learn how to undo my belt with one hand and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so just take a quick look. You need to understand these issues in your patients, because otherwise you don't talk about it, they don't talk about it, no one's talking about it, and they don't get it. Other people who had a stroke of a similar sort, I would do that. Bingo? 100%.
things person stands up and gives a big talk about task-specific training. And something else is new, that if you put a task to things, people do better. So I'm not sure. And then now they found that animals do well with task-specific repetitive training. No kidding, they get like a little cookie, the rats get these little pellets every time. So it's like, yeah, I figured out if you give me food, I'll do better too. Like, if you make me stand up 20 times and I get a little treat, I'm going to do better too. So it's like we spent probably $8 million to find out about, task-specific lower